This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
Thank you for downloading this episode of In Our Time. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. 20,000 years ago, much of northern Europe was covered in thick ice. A prehistoric visitor to what is now the British Isles would have found much of the north covered by an ice sheet, while even the south would have been barren and freezing cold. This episode from our past is frequently called the Ice Age, but that's not strictly accurate. In fact, the latest Ice Age began millions of years ago, and we're still in it. We won't emerge from it until the ice caps in Greenland and the Antarctic melt sometime in the distant future. Ice ages are periods of dramatic global cooling. Earth has experienced several of these episodes in its history, some of them hundreds of millions of years ago. They've had a huge effect on the way the planet looks and on the organisms living on it. But how do we know about ice ages, what causes them, and why do they come to an end? With me to discuss ice ages are Jane Francis, Professor of Paleoclimatology at the University of Leeds, Richard Caulfield, a Visiting Research Fellow in the Department of Earth Sciences at Oxford University, and Carrie Lear, Senior Lecturer in Paleoceanography at Cardiff University. Richard Caulfield, I've just mentioned in the introduction the term Ice Age is often misused. And in the notes, I've had Ice Age, Ice Epochs and all this. Could you clear all that up now and get going?
The phrase Ice Age is a sort of early 20th century term, which reflects the fact that people thought there was only one or a couple and they were in the relatively recent geological past. What's happened in the 70 years since then is that people have realised that in the more recent geological past, by which I mean the last 2.7 million years, there have been many ice ages, many more than the four that were originally thought. And also we now recognise that there have been five intervals in the history of the Earth, the 4.5 billion year history of the Earth, which we call ice house Earths as opposed to greenhouse Earths. And the point being that there are five intervals in the history of our planet which have been conducive to the growth of ice at the poles. And superimposed on these five major periods are intervals of much shorter frequency, glacials and interglacials, which occur on a time scale of a few tens to hundreds of thousands of years. And then on even higher frequencies, there's stadials and interstadials, which occur on time scales of tens of thousands of years.
So since 4.5 billion years ago, roughly, there's been ice around, coming and going, sometimes massively, and inside these great epochs there have been shorter bursts of ice ages which have come and gone, and periods between ice ages which have been where the Antarctic has been full of forests and that sort of thing.
Correct.
So the whole thing has been coming and going for about 4.5 million. That's sort of about it.
That's right. If you think of it as a percentage, 15% of the history of the Earth has been ice house conditions. The other 85 has been greenhouse Earth conditions.
Have you any idea how many? Can you tell the listeners how many ice ages there have been? Because we don't want to throttle them with figures at the start, but one or two of them are intriguing.
Okay. Well, there's these five glacial epochs, these ice house Earths, and then within that there have been hundreds of glaciations and interglacials.
Now tell us, what do you mean by a glaciation?
A glaciation is when there is ice on one or both poles, and when
like now,
because we're in we're actually in an interglacial now, but only 18,000 years ago was the last glacial maximum, when the ice sheets extended down across much of North America and across much of Europe, as you said in your introduction, to northern Germany. So that was the height of the last glacial maximum. That's a glaciation to a geologist. And then in the 10,000 years since about 8,000 years ago, since 18,000 years ago, sorry, we've come out of that. It takes about 10,000 years to come out of an ice age into an interglacial. It takes 100,000 years to go into an ice age, 10,000 years to come out of an ice age. And of these ice ages, these glacial interglacial cycles within what we call the late Cenozoic glacial age, which is the last 2.7 million years, there have been hundreds of ice ages.
So we have to build in, Jane Francis, when we're looking at the history of the planet, we have to build in a fact that most people don't build, that evolution and so on, there's ice around affecting it, destroying it, helping it all the time. It's been a big factor in the process. You couldn't call it really development of the planet. But can you tell us what the Earth is like between ice ages? Richard's mentioned that we're interglacial between, although technically, according to what you've all said, because of snow at the bottom and snow at the top, we're in an ice age still.
Well, let's look at it in a geological time scale, being a geologist. So if we go back through millions of years to these five periods of, let's call it an ice house, which I define as the times when there is an ice cap on one or both poles on the globe. So there are these five periods. So if we look between those five ice houses, we're in what we call a greenhouse world, where there is no ice on Earth at all. So there were times, in fact, a lot of Earth history is defined by times when the polar regions were free of ice, which is quite unusual, actually, if you think about it today. So we're so used to having an ice house world. But this is when, so between ice houses, the polar regions were, like you said, covered in forests, covered in animals, and there was no ice or very small amounts of ice around. Very different world.
You use the word defined. Do you mean that helped the planet because there was no ice at the south or the north poles?
No, it helps us define the time periods when there's ice on Earth. But yeah, but there are definitely times in the geological past when we have geological evidence for ice in the polar regions, and then there are times when there's absolutely no ice at all that we can see in the polar regions, and instead it looks like global warmth spread right to the polar regions, and it was too warm on Earth for ice to exist.
Let's talk about evidence for a while now, because that's one of the fascinating things, and as Richard hinted, evidence with research over the last 70 years has accreted considerably in different ways. Talk about the geological evidence for ice ages. Jane, can you tell us something about that?
Well, if I go out into the field with my hammer, I can actually collect physical evidence of ice. So there, we find rock types that we can see were formed when ice was present on the Earth. So one of these is classically called a glacial tillite, and it's a rock that was formed by a glacier grinding its way down a valley, picking up all different kinds of rocks as it went down a valley, churning them all together, and then dumping them in a big mass. I mean, today you can go to the Arctic and see these big dumps of what we call moraine, but that over millions of years turns to a rock type which we call tillites. So when we see a glacial tillite in the rock record, we know that a glacier has been there. We can also see rock platforms, so areas where rock surfaces have been exposed, and we can see great big scratches and trails through on top of this rock platform. And that's where millions of years ago a glacier was sitting there, and it had lumps of rock frozen into its base, and it ground its way across that rock platform and gouged out long furrows. And then the ice is melting and the rocks are gone, and it just left those furrows still preserved as fossil traces of where that glacier moved millions of years ago.
You keep using the word millions. Is it possible to define that more precisely?
Okay, so of the five ice ages that Richard was talking about, there's a very famous, or two ice ages sort of in what we call the Precambrian, so that's billions of years ago. And then there was a short ice age in what we call the Ordovician about 400 million years ago. And we know that geological evidence that I've just described, we see evidence for ice. The interesting thing about the Ordovician glaciation, it was quite short, but to see the geological evidence for it, you have to go to the Sahara. So there's a nice paradox. In the Sahara, when you're baking hot, you can be working on rocks that were formed about 400 million years ago that represent glaciation. And that's because at that time, 400 million years ago, northern Africa was over the South Pole. And then, so moving forward in time, there was a huge ice age in the southern hemisphere, just in the southern hemisphere, called Gondwana glaciation, that covered that big landmass of Gondwana.
Gondwana was a great landmass, which is Australia, India. Yeah,
all the southern continents were together. And that was covered in ice for about 80 million years, so a long time. But the northern hemisphere was all tropical. That's quite an interesting time. And then we come on to really today, which we call the Cenozoic glaciation. But actually started about 40 million years ago with the build-up of ice in Antarctica. And then ice sheets were in Antarctica for several million years, just coming and going. And then suddenly Earth got so cold that ice caps started forming in the Arctic only about 2 million years ago. And then that's where we have ice sheets on both worlds, and we're in what we call an ice age, which Richard was talking about, where we can see glacials and interglacials.
So let's continue in looking for evidence, Carrie Lear. Jane's mentioned the Antarctic. Was that getting colder and colder? And a lot of evidence, as I've read, comes from the sea, and that was a very effective factor in the Antarctic. Could you tell us about that and explain what an oxygen isotope is and why the evidence from that is useful?
So the kind of features that Jane was just describing gives really useful direct evidence of these past glaciations, but they've got disadvantages to them as well for paleoclimatologists, and that's because those records tend to not be complete and sometimes they're quite difficult to date as well. But when we turn to the oceans, what we find is that over time there's layer upon layer of sediment constantly accumulating on the seafloor. And as this sediment builds up into a big sediment pile, it's basically giving us a really valuable archive of past changes in climate. And one of the most powerful tools we can use to get the climate signal out of this archive is the what we call the oxygen isotope paleothermometer.
Can you...
Okay, so within this sediment, there are these tiny, tiny microfossils, the size of a pinhead, called foraminifera. And we can analyse their oxygen isotope ratio, the ratio of oxygen 18 to oxygen 16. And that depends on two factors. The first is the temperature that these foraminifera lived in. And the second is the oxygen isotope ratio of the seawater they lived in. And the reason that that's really useful to us is because when seawater evaporates at low latitude, water molecules containing that light isotope, oxygen 16, are preferentially evaporated. So you have all this water vapour above the oceans enriched in this light isotope. And if that water vapour moves to higher latitude, some of it will rain out and you'll preferentially lose the heavy isotope. And so as you go higher and higher latitudes, this water vapour is getting more and more enriched in this light isotope. So the end result of this fractionation is that snow that falls on the poles that's going to make up our ice sheets is really enriched in the light isotope, oxygen 16. So if you grow a large ice sheet at the poles, you're locking up this light isotope out of the oceans, and that's leaving the oceans enriched in heavy isotope, and that is reflected in the composition of these tiny microfossils that we can pick out of the sediments and analyse. And the great thing about this is we can get continuous records and we can date these records as well.
So that's a good laboratory for ice ages, the bottom of the ocean.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
What about other evidence? Is that the main evidence that can be gleaned from oceans, or is there other evidence? What about coral reef evidence, for instance?
Okay, so coral reefs are really useful because we can use them to look at past changes of sea level. So as you grow an ice sheet, you're locking up all this water out of the oceans, so sea level will fall. To put this in some sort of perspective, 20,000 years ago, the last glacial maximum, sea level was about 100 metres lower than it is today. And the last interglacial...
20,000 years ago?
Yeah, 100 metres lower. The last interglacial, which was 125,000 years ago, sea level was about 5 or 6 metres higher than today. So these are big changes in sea level, and there's different ways that we can reconstruct these changes in sea level through time. And one of these, as you said, is the coral reef dipstick. And that's because coral reefs grow at sea level. So if we find ancient coral reefs at different elevations to today, we can date the corals using radiometric dating and look at their elevation and work out how sea level has changed through time.
So a bit of coral sticking up is like a tidal mark when the river came this high in 1962, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Except it's 1962 million years ago.
Yeah.
So that's what you get out of the oceans, because we're looking for where we get evidence. We talked about geology with Jane, and we're talking about evidence from the oceans now, getting this ice age. So Richard Caulfield, can we talk about one or two of the more dramatic things which gives us an idea of the evidence? I'm fascinated, as everybody will be, by this manifestation of snowball Earth, the idea of the white planet spinning through the universe covered in ice and snow. Not so long ago, in the terms of the three of you around this table, 400, 500 million years. Can you tell us about that, why it happened?
Yeah, one thing I think I would quite like to say is that if we think about the history of the Earth as a 24-hour clock, as we've done many times before in this program, the first of these large ice house Earths occurred at about noon, 12 hours after midnight. The second, the one that you're talking about, Melvin, the Cryogenian, occurred at about 8 o'clock at night, i.e. very recently to a geologist, but that's still 800 million years ago. And then the more recent ones that Jane was talking about, the Ordovician and the one we're in at the moment, occurred sort of at 10 o'clock, and then obviously the one at the moment is basically at midnight. Another thing to say is that although our ice age has only lasted 2.7 million years...
Our ice age is...
The one we're in at the moment.
That's right, yeah.
The conditions which led up to it started, as Jane said, about 40 million years ago with the thermal isolation of Antarctica.
Now, just a second. The thermal isolation of Antarctica, I meant to pick that up with Carrie and I didn't. Can you just explain that?
Yes. The conditions necessary to form ice on the planet in these five ice houses that we've talked about are always linked to the presence of ice, of land at the poles, and or a blockage of ocean circulation.
So there's got to be land under the ice, under the snow, in order to make...
There has to be land at the poles for the ice to accrete on.
Mm.
And each of these five intervals of Earth history had land on the poles which allowed the ice to form. Now, you asked about the Cryogenian, this 800 million-year-old ice age, which occurred just before the evolution of the shelly animals, the things that gave rise to us. And they call this the snowball Earth because it appears that ice extended not just from the poles down as far as North Germany or down as far as Wisconsin, as is the case with the ice age we're in at the moment, but in fact completely encircled the globe. So the if you think about the Jovian moon Europa, which is completely covered in ice, the Earth would have looked like that 800 million years ago. This is the granddaddy of all ice house Earths.
And how did we get out of that? That's an epic movie rather than a conversation, isn't it?
Yes, yes. I'm surprised, it hasn't been done, actually. But how did we get out of that? Well, the answer is probably by increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is put there by volcanism.
I'm going to come to carbon dioxide. Yeah. It's a big subject. Jane Francis, can we talk about the continent called Gondwana, which you mentioned, and the evidence of the ice age there, and the shift in the continental drift, really, is what we're talking about.
This was a really massive glaciation or ice house period. And what
I'm sorry to be a bore, but can you give us a date or two?
Roughly about 350 million years ago and finished roughly about 250 million years ago.
Right.
So it's actually...
As if I can get a fix on
that. Yeah, no. For geologists, that's sort of about the middle of Earth history.
It's about half past 10 at night, 24 o'clock.
That's a bit helpful, but still, right.
It's a long time, so this is, 80 to 100 million years when there was ice across Gondwana. So all the southern continents were amassed together to form one big landmass. And what we can see from geological evidence, so geologists going in the field looking at the rocks, we can see that there were ice caps on across this big continent. And the really interesting pattern is if you go to South America, you can see geological evidence for the ice was there. And then you can go to South Africa, You can see fantastic evidence in southern South Africa for presence of ice millions of years ago. India, which was tucked in next to Africa, Antarctica, and then Australia. So when we date these rocks, what we can see is that actually these ice caps formed when the continents were over the South Pole.
And so we're going to emphasise, I'm sorry to be so lumpen, but it was a lump. It was a huge
lump, one big mass. Yeah. It was all joined together. But that one big landmass through that time period that I mentioned was moving across the South Pole. And as the land went across the South Pole, it got very cold, and ice caps formed. So we can see a continuous pattern of ice that formed from South America, South Africa, Antarctica, India, and then Australia. Beautiful evidence for glaciation in the rock record. And so this is a massive ice age, about 80 million years. The really interesting thing is we'd see no evidence of that in the Northern Hemisphere, because all the continents in at that time period were all near the equator. So North America, Europe, you know, where UK was, and across to China, were all in sort of what we would call a tropical belt near the equator. And that's the time when we know about all the coal forests, all the lush tropical forests that were living in hot, warm, wet environments, forming all the coal that we have today. And so we don't have really a very balanced Earth. There weren't many continents at the North Pole at that time. So we had this big ice cap in the Southern Hemisphere and warm, lush environments in the tropical regions in the Northern Hemisphere. But the two were linked, because as the ice sheets, these big ice sheets in the Southern Hemisphere, waxed and waned and they melted and they grew, they affected the sea level, and that affected all the shorelines and the sea level in the Northern Hemisphere. And we can see that in the rock record as well. So the ocean is a really important, as Carrie was saying, and the ocean is really important not only for its record, but also the connector between ice sheets and the rest of the world.
And is it right that the Antarctic got so very cold because of a particular current of sea that encircled it and cut off its access to any warmer water?
That comes later.
Right.
So this Gondwanan ice age that I was mentioning is about sort of 300 million years ago. And then the continents moved away from the pole, and so all the ice melted. And we were out of an ice age, we were into a greenhouse world. And then later on, when we come to about 40 million years ago, roughly, we then go into what we call the Cenozoic Ice Age, which is when Antarctica was isolated.
Is that what we call the present day, the beginning of the present
age? Beginning of present day.
So can I go to you, Carrie? Can you tell us how that began, the present ice age, 40 million years ago?
Well, it's probably best to start off thinking about 50 million years ago, which is a time that we call the early Eocene climatic optimum.
Geologists.
Well, we know that 50 million years ago, there was no ice anywhere. So that is this greenhouse world that we've been mentioning. So we have high CO2, Antarctica's vegetated, you know, we've got mangrove swamps along the south of the UK, really warm global climate.
As a matter of interest, we also have the time, just about the time, when we, as it were, what we became, appeared as mammals. Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's
so
right.
Yeah. Maybe a warm planet was not a bad thing for humankind. Yeah, but we can leave that. And
the dead dinosaurs was an even better thing.
We can park that. Carrie, you were saying.
Okay, and then we have over the next 10 million years or so, global climate undergoes this pretty steady cooling trend. And towards the end of this trend, we start to see these isolated glaciers on Antarctica and maybe sporadic larger glaciers. Some people have termed this interval the Doubt House world, so we're not really sure about the extent of ice at this point. But then suddenly, 34 million years ago, this is the transition between the Eocene epoch and the Oligocene epoch. Antarctica becomes fully glaciated, and that happens really quickly.
Do you know why?
There's probably a combination of the gateways being open, so this current that you've been mentioning, but primarily CO2. So through this time, CO2 levels have declined, causing global cooling. And what happens is it goes, the climate system probably passed through a threshold. So what that means really is that on Antarctica, the snow that was probably falling in winter was able to stay all year round. So it just didn't melt away again in summer. And so if that happens year upon year, you know, very slowly, these accumulations of snow can build up a large ice sheet. And when I say this happened quickly, I mean quickly to a geologist. That's less than 500,000 years.
Very quickly.
Yeah. So let's just stick with the present ice age. We're about 30, 34 million years ago now. Richard Caulfield, can we not just talk about the causes of ice age, but be specific to this one, because we've been, you know, anyway, this one, the cause of, what role, and Jane said quite a deal about this, is there any more to say about the role of the position of the continents play in this?
Right, well, Jane's explained that once Antarctica isolated itself over the South Pole, it was surrounded by the Southern Ocean, the Roaring Forties, and this thermally isolated it, so it was not picking up heat from the equator. And as Carrie has said, snow was falling on it and not melting. And actually, this is a major feature of ice ages. It's not that it's abrupt, it's just that there's a change in the balance between how much snow falls and melts. So if you're going into an ice age, you're accreting, as it were, year by year, more snow. So, and then, of course, you go into a positive feedback effect, because snow is shiny, it has a high albedo, and it reflects...
What's more, albedo?
The reflectivity of a surface. And it reflects sunlight back into space. So if you've got, as it were, ice caps on the poles, north and south, south at the moment, it's reflecting energy back into space, and so it's getting colder and colder. And the colder it gets, the more cold it will get, because the ice sheet is getting bigger and reflecting more energy. It's a positive feedback loop. Until eventually you've cooled the Earth enough so that you're getting ice on the North Pole, which is why the conditions necessary for the current ice age took about 40 million years to perfect themselves, if I can put it like that. And then only in the last 2.7 million years have we actually had fully fledged glacial interglacial cycles. And I know that you're going to ask me about orbital variations around the sun. And
later.
Okay. But what I was going to say is that this... that particular type of modulation only manifests itself as ice ages when conditions are optimal for the formation of an ice house Earth. But these orbital variations can also be found without ice ages, but they don't manifest themselves as ice ages.
You wanted to come in, Joan?
Yeah, I was just going to say that we have, from a geologist's point of view, we were beginning to build up now a really quite good picture of the history of glaciation into our present ice age, so from about 34 million years ago. And we can, because one of the problems, if you're a geologist and you go to Antarctica and you try and look at the history of the rocks, is there's a very large ice sheet on top of Antarctica that's covering everything up. And so the ice sheet is its own worst enemy, in that it not only erodes its history, but it covers it up so we can't see it. So we have to drill off the margins of Antarctica. We use a sort of an oil rig and drill into the rock record that's on the edges. But we are starting to build up a really good picture.
When you say we, I must tell listeners that's very much you going out there with your ice pick.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and quite a lot of other
never
people
happy,
as well.
As I understand it.
Happy days drilling away in the rocks in Antarctica.
In Antarctica. Yeah. Now,
but so we've got really quite a good picture now of how the ice sheet's built up, and it's really interesting because the ice, as Carrie said, the ice appeared. I think there was ice on Antarctica for quite some time before that, as small ice caps. But suddenly, at this particular point, 34 million years ago, it must have got quite cold. The ice expanded, and we can see that there were big ice sheets in Antarctica. Sometimes they shrunk, sometimes they grew. So there was quite a long time of, well, almost 32 million years when there were ice sheets just coming and going, coming and going. And what's happening is it's cooling the Earth. It's like having a big refrigerator, a big ice cube on the bottom of the world, which is gradually cooling the Earth's climate.
But that's not yet a fully fledged ice age. That's, sorry to interrupt, Joan. It's just the preconditioning the Earth for ice ages. And of course, sorry to interrupt, Joan, but the reason we know this so well is because it's relatively recent history. The last 60 million years of Earth history is a very well understood book indeed. Sorry.
Well, what I was going to say is that the Earth gradually becomes cooler and cooler, became cooler and cooler, and then only when the Earth was cold enough did the ice sheets build up around the Arctic, which is a very sort of geologically recent history, only 2 million years ago.
So we've looked at geology and we've looked at the oceans and looked at continental drift. Before we move on to CO2, to carbon dioxide, is there any other sources of evidence that have been helpful to a study of the ice ages in the over the last 60 or 70 years, Carrie? Because we're going to turn to chemistry. So anything else before we turn to the big CO2 question?
Are the geochemical proxies, you mean?
Mm.
I suppose one really useful one that's just come out in the last sort of 10 to 15 years would be magnesium calcium paleothermometry. And the reason this is really useful for us, if you remember I was talking about oxygen isotopes, that contains two signals within it, the temperature and the ice volume. And the first oxygen isotope records of these glaciations were published in the 50s and 60s. So we've had them for decades, but even though they're these fantastic quantitative records, we haven't really been able to look at them and tease apart these two variables. But in the last 10 to 15 years, lots of new geochemical proxies have started to come on the scene. And one of these is this magnesium calcium paleothermometer, which basically gives us an independent temperature record, which means all of a sudden we can separate out these two variables in the oxygen isotope record. So we can start to say this is how much the ice sheet grew at specific times in the past and how that was related to temperature changes.
You want to go in?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk to you very briefly, I think for the sake of completeness, about quite an old-fashioned way of measuring temperature in the deep oceans. Before oxygen isotopes, people used to measure the species composition of the planktonic foraminiferal assemblages, which Carrie mentioned, which we measure individual forams for their oxygen isotope values. But in fact, you can just look at the different types of species, and these vary according to whether or not it's a glacial or an interglacial.
For instance?
There was a project in the early 1970s called CLIMAP, C-L-I-M-A-P, and what the two geologists in America, John Imbery and his student, were doing is looking at the different composition of these assemblages and number crunching this composition through a computer. And they were able to calibrate that assemblage against the modern day so accurately that it was possible to reconstruct the surface of the Ice Age Earth 18,000 years ago using just the species composition of planktonic forams and calibrate that against the oxygen isotope ratio.
Can I come now to the atmosphere and particularly carbon dioxide, Jane Francis, about which we've heard a great deal? What role does that play in the Ice Ages?
Well, it's very important in regulating
we've
temperature.
We've heard a great deal, I mean, recently, yes. Not around this table yet. Right. Okay.
And it would have done in the geological past. And one of the interesting sources of information about CO2 in the past are from ice cores. So now we're coming into very recent history, about the last 800,000 years. And so glaciologists can drill ice cores through the big ice caps. They've done that in big projects in Greenland and in Antarctica. And drilled hundreds of metres of ice core. And the ice cores record very faithfully the climate almost on an annual band. So when you find an ice core, it's segmented almost like tree rings. And within each annual band, there are tiny bubbles that are preserved in the ice, which are full of the atmosphere that was present thousands of years ago. And so what the glaciologists do is they slice up their ice cores and then they treat them and release the gas from these air bubbles and can measure the atmosphere millions of years ago. And that gives us a record of the carbon dioxide levels. And we can see that that's, along with other ideas, we can see that that's a record of the temperature. So the CO2 is giving us a record of the variation of temperature when we're in an ice house world with ice on Earth.
May I turn to Carol Leora? What role does carbon dioxide play in the initiation of ice ages?
I think it comes down to this idea of thresholds. So the carbon dioxide level, will set the main climate state of the world. So if we look at this kind of past 50 million years that we keep coming back to, at the beginning, carbon dioxide levels were pretty high, probably, I don't know, about 1,000 ppm. And they've declined over this interval, and as they decline, climate cools, and they pass through various thresholds for each of the different ice sheets. So the first threshold you pass through would have been 34 million years ago, and that's when we formed the main East Antarctic ice sheet. And then later on, through the Cenozoic, they've declined further to the point that we now have Northern Hemisphere glaciation.
Are we talking about carbon dioxide as the major and crucial determinant in this?
Yes.
This is in the initiation. But does this, Richard Caulfield, necessarily continue? It's the major initiating factor, you're saying, the level of carbon dioxide.
Well, it's the flux of carbon dioxide, the movement of carbon dioxide in and out of the. There are three big sinks on this planet. There's the atmosphere, there's the ocean, and then there's the rock, the lithosphere. And carbon moves in and out of these three sinks. And what happens is that if you have an ice age, you have relatively low carbon dioxide, which is about 350 parts per million at the moment. But it was 8 times higher in the late Cretaceous, which is 70 million years ago. Mm. And we know the late Cretaceous was very warm. And in fact, it's possible to correlate times of temperature with carbon dioxide throughout the geological history of the world. And in fact, carbon dioxide is the major factor controlling temperature in the last 2 billion years.
So we have another major factor, though, which I said we'd get on to, which is the Milankovitch cycles. Your point, Jane's point to Carrie.
This is Carrie's expertise.
Carrie's expertise. Can you briefly tell us about the Milankovitch cycles and why, what importance they play? Hmm. So we now say that carbon dioxide is the major player in this, but the gene initiating it, and then we have the Milankovitch cycles, which cause it to increase and multiply.
Well, okay,
you tell me if they don't.
Well, Milankovitch cycles are cycles in the way that the Earth orbits the Sun. So they're called Milankovitch cycles because a Serbian mathematician called Milankovitch, during the First World War, calculated the effect that these changes would have had on the amount of energy that our planet receives for different latitudes. So it affects the distribution of energy, the seasons, and also the total amount of energy. These cycles have gone on through Earth's history. So you can't say that they're a cause of ice ages because they occur during these greenhouse worlds. But what a better term for them is pacemakers. So what they do is they trigger some initial change, and that initial change probably would be, say, a cooling of summers, Northern Hemisphere summers, for example. And that might set into play a whole series of feedback systems within the climate system, typically involving levels of carbon dioxide.
Right. I mean, the Milankovitch cycle affects glacial cyclicity via the mechanism of carbon dioxide, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. There's three main cycles. There's obliquity, precession and eccentricity. And obliquity is probably quite an easy one to think about in terms of the impact on ice ages. So that's the tilt of the axis of rotation of the Earth. So if there was no tilt on our axis of rotation, we wouldn't have any seasons because certain times of year the hemispheres wouldn't be pointing towards or away from the sun. And the amount of this tilt has changed in the past, which affects the how extreme seasons are.
And the important impact that this has had in our last glaciation is that its effect is a sort of, as Carrie said, it's a pacemaker. So once we're in an ice age, this is a control that paces into glaciers and glacials warming and cooling while we're still in an ice house. And we know that this has happened on a timescale of about 100,000 years.
Yeah.
For the last 800,000 years. So we go into we're still in our ice house, our present day ice age, but we go into a cooler phase, a colder phase, and then 100,000 years later we get warmer and then cooler and warmer. So there are paces, warming and cooling, which we call glacials and interglacials.
Can I come, Richard Coffey, with the onset of the current ice age, how has it affected life on Earth? And let's talk about us, because there's too much life to talk about here. I mean, human life, humankind. It seems that that when the death of the dinosaurs allowed small mammals to emerge,
right,
became us, but it was a time of warmth, of
yes,
warming.
Yes.
300 million years ago, there was warmth again, and the development of what became us was increased, and people left Africa and started to move around. So
right.
In both cases, global warming benefited what became us here now.
That's
now, maybe
true.
That'd be a bad thing, but it seems to be what happened.
Mm. Well, I mean, there is this idea that at the height of the last glacial maximum and even before, somewhere within the cycles of the last 2.7 million years, the environmental changes were sufficiently stressful that it drove natural selection towards increased brain size and the development of some kind of society and hunter-gathering, the ability to work together became highly adaptive, useful in terms of evolutionary advantage. So it would seem that the, as it were, extreme environmental variability of the last 2.7 million years, when we were swinging in and out of these sequence of ice ages, drove natural selection faster than normal, which resulted in a particular species of naked bipedal ape, us, having an above average cranial size. And that, of course, has resulted in us. But I think you can find the roots of human evolution, not necessarily in warmth or necessarily in cold, but in enhanced climatic variability.
Yes, I wish we'd another, because there's some. I'm skipping like mad here, and it's annoying the heck out of me on my notes. Never mind. We've got very little time. What's going to happen? As far as you three geologists are concerned, we're in an ice age. We're coming to the end, and you're calling it becoming interglacial between ice ages here. As you see it from a geological point of view, what's happening next? Because we've seen dramas happen without human interference for millions and even billions of years. And now, of course, the story is that human interference is going to exacerbate or influence, modify those dramas. So can you give us a steer on that, starting mm-hmm. with you, Jane?
Well, we know from, as I mentioned, in the ice core records and the carbon dioxide records, that when the Earth, for the last 800,000 years, has been going in these glacials into glacials, there's always been a window of CO2 levels up to 280 parts per million. So even it's got warm, cool, warm, cold, and glaciers have waxed and waned, it's always stayed within this envelope of 280 parts per million of CO2. Fairly stable, warm, cool, warm, cool. Where we are now, of course, the CO2 levels are at 394 parts per million. So we're way, way outside of that envelope. So to get to those carbon dioxide levels, we have to go back and look at the record millions of years to find that. So I think we're outside of that envelope where we are likely just to go back into a smooth glacial phase. We're way outside that. So we probably are heading into a proper greenhouse climate. And I think a lot of the we'll see glaciers on an Earth melt.
But a greenhouse climate, of course, is the natural condition for the Earth. 85% of Earth history has been greenhouse. 70 million years ago, carbon dioxide levels were 8 times higher than they are at the moment, which made them 2,400 parts per million. Before that, they were 12 times higher. The only certainty is that climate change is a natural part of the Earth. And as a species, we may have been the result of climate change. We may now be altering it, but anyhow, we'd have to deal with it. So I think we are going to have to geoengineer our own climate to deal with it. Nothing wrong with that.
Carrie, could you have a final short word, I'm afraid?
Just looking at the paleoclimate record, at modern-day levels of CO2, the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet are not stable. So I think unless we reduce our current levels, they're doomed. Afraid.
Well, it's been a heck of a story, with or without us. So, thank you very much, Jane Frances Carrillier and Richard Caulfield. Next week we'll be talking about Evelyn Waugh's first novel, Decline and Fall, published in 1928 and still a wonder.
There are many more Radio 4 arts and discussion programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.